the outset to just revisit a small problem from last night. Before we get to some of the same or similar, we don't have a lot, but we have some other language that the conference committee can consider. After that, the Rivers and Carlson and I, or through staff, have put together some considerations, House and Senate, for issues that we might discuss. If we find that there are legislators who are here to discuss, who are not conferees, who are here to discuss parts of the respective bills, we'll take those legislators first. And then just proceed through some of these issues so we can have some discussion as to some of the differences between the House and the Senate. What we're going to do, once we do this small language, however, is we're going to go first to Representative Winkler, who I saw some that there is, because last night we were going to talk about the Toxic Kids proposal of the House, and I think, Representative Winkler, you were maybe on your way back. You weren't driving fast enough to get here, so to be fair to you, we'll put you first. So, but first we have an amendment. Has it been distributed? A72. All right. If we can distribute that,
could be.
There's an agenda.
This is the high one. Mr. Chairman, I will move the amendment to get it before us, and then if Mr. Marks could get the conference committee up to date on what the language is for and what it's needed for.
I think the conferees have it. So, Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, members, last night on your list of same and similar provisions, under House Article 7, the first one that was listed was called Next Generation 9/11 Internet Protocol Carry Forward Spending Authority. And we pulled that one off the list. It went because there were some concerns about it. If you want to follow along, it's in the comparison book under Article 7, Public Safety, and it's on page R11-A7. But this is some language that allows the relevant language here is actually on page R12, and it allows a appropriation that was authorized in 2009 to carry forward or to be available until expended. After doing some checking on this, discovering the appropriation probably should have canceled back in 2011, what we're recommending is to take the Senate language on this, so it would be that Senate Section 1, line 15.3 off of, or starting on line 15.3 off of page R11, plus the amendment, which would put a retroactive effective date on this and essentially make it effective prior to it canceling in June of 2011. So the motion would probably be the A72 amendment or plus the Senate section or Article 2, Section 1.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, I'll make that motion then.
So we have Representative Carlson's motion in front of us. Is there discussion on that? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. So let's, as I mentioned, go to Representative Winkler. Have a presentation on the Toxic Kids legislation, which is found in the Department of Health, but I
recognize it's supposed to be Toxic Free Kids.
Toxic Free Kids.
I'm sorry, Toxic Free Kids.
Not Toxic
Kids. Oh, I see, that's right.
So at a certain point, some parents may think that they are.
The kids are toxic, but in this case,
we're talking
sorry.
The toxic free kids. Yeah.
My apologies to all the
Mr.
kids.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, especially during cold and flu season, I think it would be okay to call them toxic children, toxic kids.
So, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the conference committee for inviting me up today. The toxic free kids legislation is contained in the House bill, not in the Senate bill. This was originally moved forward in the House in 2013. It made it through most of the committee process until it stopped moving in the Senate. Originally, the bill contained a phase-out of certain priority chemicals that the Department of Health has determined may be detrimental to children's health. In addition to a phase-out of the use of those chemicals over time, the bill contained a provision requiring individual labels on individual products that are offered to consumers. Because of the committee progress last session, we came back this year and substantially revised the bill as it moved through the House. Today, the Toxic Free Kids Act essentially creates a reporting requirement. So companies that are putting products into the stream of commerce, marketing them for as children's products, have to report to the state of Minnesota whether those products contains the 9 priority chemicals currently identified by the Minnesota Department of Health as being potentially harmful to children. And without the provision in state law, there would be no applicable federal law that would be robust enough to provide consumers with information on individual products that are available and that they are purchasing for their children. In years going forward, they would, every 3 years, continue to be required to bring those reports back to the state of Minnesota. And I would emphasize again, this does not require them to stop using those chemicals. It does not require them to put labels on them for consumers, as has been discussed in this bill and other bills in the past. It simply is providing information that the state of Minnesota, through the PCA, would post on its website so that if consumers were interested in this information, it would be available. And without this legislation, specific product-specific information based on priority chemicals identified by the Minnesota Department of Health would not be available for consumers for children's products.
Representative Winkler, a couple of questions. First of all, there's an appropriation of about, I think, $348,000 for this biennium, and then carry the tail. So what's the appropriation for? Is that for the website or?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, this is Representative Wagenius' section of the bill, and she has identified the funding sources, but it is essentially for the reporting requirements for the Department of, or for the PCA to accept the reports, make them available to the public, and process them. And there is an ongoing, I think, 3-year cycle for companies to continue to make those reports. So it is to cover the cost for the PCA.
And so, how does this, in terms of a particular chemical, how does it get to the website?
Mr. Chairman, the Department of Health identifies the chemicals that are priorities that based on health determinations of what could be toxic to children. The list of prior of those 9 priority chemicals are then publicly available. They are today. That could be changed over time. But those 9 chemicals that we've currently identified are known to the manufacturers about whether or not they are contained in the products or not. So the manufacturer reports to the PCA whether any of those 9 chemicals are contained in the children's product that they are marketing.
Okay. So this is a state promulgated list as opposed to a federally promulgated list of chemicals?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
So hypothetically, pick a chemical that it's felt by Minnesota's Department of Health this might have some harmful impacts on children, but maybe in Wisconsin they may not feel the same way. A chemical is not going to change from state to state. That's why I'm wondering about Minnesota's promulgation as opposed to something else.
Well, Mr. Chairman, obviously the effects are the effects, and it's a question of policy, whether or not the state wants to inform consumers about the existence of that chemical in the children's product or not. So the policy difference is the difference between Minnesota and Wisconsin. And it isn't that the State Department of Health sort of feels like doing this. It is based on peer-reviewed research and the best evidence available about what children, what levels of these toxic chemicals are safe for children. And the research, I think, is relatively robust. And the Minnesota Department of Health, of course, has is a highly respected organization.
So if you take whatever hypothetical chemical, if I go to the website, do I look this up by the chemical and see what foods are would contain this chemical, or do I go to Oreo cookie and see if that has any chemicals? How does it work?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean, the database could, I'm sure, be searched in any way that you would like. Okay. But the idea is that you provide product-specific information to consumers. Under federal regulations, for example, you can look at potentially types of, you know, general categories of products, but you don't know if one product versus another contains that particular chemical or not. So this is getting it right down to the individual product level, which if you look at it from a consumer first standpoint, the consumer has to be able to know which individual item they're buying and whether that contains the product. Having large categories of information out there that aren't product specific is not very useful to someone who's trying to make a decision about what kind of baby formula to buy or what kind of chewable toy to buy.
And that was my last question. The kinds of products, obviously foods, children's toys, what other kinds of products would be listed?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think a pretty simple, if you go to the infant and toddler section at Target, you'd probably find just about everything that would be covered. Anything from teething rings and toys that they chew on to stuffed animals. It can be clothing items. It can be sheets or other things that are offered for sale for children. We did a press event here this session with firefighters talking about the kind of health effects on firefighters of a lot of the things that people use for fire retardants in various kinds of products and the health effects that's had on them. Similar kind of analysis applies to children. They have a lot of regulation about how those products are supposed to perform, and that may lead in many cases to certain toxic chemicals being used and consumers really not having information about that. So, it could be almost anything sold to children or sold for children, I suppose.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, you and I have had some discussion about this. I spent 5 years in the toy business, worked for Tonka Toys, was disappointed when Tonka has now been acquired by Hasbro, but I can tell you that they went through, multitude of different testing requirements to bring any test to market, and because, the children's safety standards are so very, very, very strict. I can't begin to imagine how they would deal with a state-by-state requirement because first of all, most of their customers are national, and so they deliver products to regional warehouses, and then those regional distribution centers deliver the product. So how would the industry deal with this kind of requirement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, I think they would deal with it in Minnesota much the way they deal with it in the state of Washington, which also has this reporting requirement. The Minnesota law, as passed by the House, would be very similar, not exactly the same, but quite similar to what Washington has. It doesn't change what products are going to be sold in Minnesota. It doesn't change what products would be distributed to a regional distribution center. It simply requires that if the product contains one of the 9 priority chemicals, which are well known in advance, they have to report that to the state. It doesn't change in any way what they can offer for sale in Minnesota. It simply says they have to identify what those products are. So I would imagine that if they wanted to be over-inclusive, they could include every product that they put into the stream of commerce in the United States. Or if they can do it on a regional or state-specific basis, they could do that as well. But the data would exist. It's just a matter of how it's reported to the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, what's your opinion with regard to the federal requirements on the same subset of chemicals? How does the federal government deal with our particular Minnesota subset that have been identified by the Department of Health?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, I am not an expert in the federal law. My understanding of the federal law is that there is broad agreement that this law is out of date and is not providing the comprehensive regulation that people are looking for. We hear in committee testimony, we've heard a lot of what I would consider rhetoric about how we all agree that this law needs to change, and yet somehow for 14, 15 years, nothing has actually been done at the federal level. And as states have looked at state-based regulation, they have often referred to the federal legislation, but it just never happens. And I think it's really important to understand that we have no system for verifying the safety of a chemical before it is placed into commerce. you do not have to get approval ahead of time before you start to sell something. So we have nothing that says in the state or at the federal level that says that a certain chemical can't be put into a product unless it goes through safety testing first. That just does not exist, and it doesn't certainly exist at the federal level.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I am interested in the subject and in learning more about it, but I can tell you that's not actually true. There are tremendous safety testing that has to happen before something goes into market. So while you may not test each chemical in aggregate, it is tested, and it's tested over and over and over and over, and it's a significant part of a company's budget.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, I wasn't suggesting that there is no safety testing for products in general, but I'm saying that there are no requirements that a chemical has to be determined to be safe before it can be placed into the stream of commerce.
So Representative Winkler, I'm a little bit confused. So let's take a toy manufacturer. I don't know, is Mattel still around?
Yes.
Okay, thanks to the expert on fun. So I don't know where Mattel Manufacturing is, where they're headquartered.
I have a good idea of where the manufacturing is, Mr. Chair.
I know where they're headquartered.
So if Mattel puts out a line of whatever, and so does somebody tell Mattel, you're manufacturing these toys with this chemical, or does Mattel self-report back to the state of Minnesota?
Well, Mr. Chair, under this bill, if Mattel is selling, or let's say Hasbro is selling a plastic Tonka truck, let's just do it simply, and as part of the plastic Tonka truck, because they used to be metal and much better, Senator Bonoff, but
yep.
The plastic versions today may contain, and this is a hypothetical, maybe they contain bisphenol A or did. Under this law, Minnesota would require Hasbro to report that Tonka truck, that plastic Tonka truck, contained bisphenol A, because that is one of the 9 priority chemicals. So they would have to then report that individual Tonka truck contains bisphenol A, and that information would be made available to Minnesota consumers. If they don't have it in there, they don't have anything to report.
But how's Hasbro going to know?
Mr. Chairman, it is their obligation to know what products, how their products are made.
No, but I understand that, but how do they know about the Minnesota law? If Hasbro is manufacturing toys from wherever, and then they go over to their distribution center, and the distribution center sends them to, 50 states in the country, how will they know that Minnesota has this law that they have to comply with?
Mr. Chair, based on the lobbying presence in the committees where this bill has moved through, I'm fairly certain the industry is well aware of the Minnesota regulation that we're considering, and it is very consistent, not identical, but quite consistent with what is already being done in the state of Washington. So the reporting is already taking place in another state, and this is providing that same information in Minnesota. Maybe I'm missing your question.
Yeah, so let me try it a different way. Hasbro, Mattel, whatever, manufacture their toys, and they're going to be distributed everywhere. How does whatever the central office is know that there's a law in Minnesota as opposed to Wisconsin or Iowa that they have to provide this information about the inclusion of this particular chemical with this particular toy? You talk about the lobbying presence in committee. The lobbyists are not going to be, jetting back to wherever the headquarters are. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not entirely sure I understand. I think that the, if you want to continue to use a toy hypothetical, the toy industry is well aware of the regulation that Minnesota is proposing. If Minnesota adopts this regulation, passes this law, the industry will know. The individual companies that are selling their products will know that there are state laws that they have to comply with.
But how do you know they'll know? If the company is located in California, how do you know that the people in California will be aware of the Minnesota law? The Toy Manufacturer Association of America might send something out. And that also begs the question. So how about if the toy manufacturer from wherever ignores the law?
Mr. Chairman, I think if I can read this note, the answer to your question is in part that the Department of Minnesota Department of Commerce is required to provide notification under the law to the companies. But I mean, I guess I'm a little bit confused because it seems to me your question kind of begs in general, how do companies know which states have which regulations? And
right.
Generally, if you want to enter the commerce in any particular state, you have to know the regulatory environment in which you're operating.
Okay, so what happens if Hasbro just ignores the Minnesota law, sends the toy to the distribution center, and it shows up in all the Target stores in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, I wish I had a copy of the bill in front of me. I have not spent – it's been some time since I looked at the enforcement provisions of the bill. But it would be – here we go. That would be helpful. Here we go. It's Section 14 of the final version of this bill. It simply requires that the State Department of Commerce provides the enforcement mechanism under their existing authority to regulate commerce in Minnesota. So I would imagine that if you're identifying toys that are coming into Minnesota, they have to first be warned that those have not been reported on and that they have to remove them. Now, the question would be if they just refuse to report or if they misreport whether those chemicals are in the products, and how would we ever know that they were doing that? I think that's a different question.
That would be the question. I mean, does somebody go to Target and pick up all the Hasbro toys? Are they enjoined from coming into Minnesota? Is there any fine mechanism? I mean, any enforcement to make sure that they are in compliance?
Mr. Chairman, there are enforcement mechanisms under existing commerce laws in Minnesota that this bill specifically references. So in the same way that any other regulatory requirement governed by state law would be enforced by the State Department of Commerce. And Mr. Chairman, I would just point out also that we had a state-based phase-out of bisphenol A in baby bottles. And the same questions, I suppose, arose when those phase-outs of those particular chemicals were adopted and passed into law in Minnesota. And I'm not aware, based on the work I've done on this bill and in conversations with a number of people, that the phase-out of those chemicals has resulted in any problem of distribution by the manufacturers or any problem of enforcement by the State Department of Commerce.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually have a couple of questions, but prior to that, why don't I just tell you that the state of Minnesota has multiple different building codes and building requirements, and many of the buildings that are built here are built by people from, are designed and built by companies that are not, do not have a domicile in the state, and they're able to figure it out, and I suspect the toy makers are as smart as the architects in this world. So, I mean, I don't want to get in the middle between two lawyers getting in a fight here, but just trying to.
Not in a fight. I just have some questions.
But I'm just trying to say that, you know, we have different road regulations, we have different labor laws, we have different building codes, and we have commerce coming from every other state and sometimes other nations building stuff here. My question to the author, though, is I'm not worried about Mattel or Hasbro or any of the others. They are big companies. They can take care of themselves. They have more lawyers than we have pages in this book, most likely. My question is, these little mom-and-pop shops that have the little toys that are painted with strange paints and different chemicals that are probably likely in them, manufactured in the same place that probably Hasbro and Mattel's toys are, and Tonka's are made, how do they track this stuff? Because I think it's really important that our children, I've watched little kids try to chew those things into pieces. I mean, they'd give my dog a good run for their money. So how do those small shops track that kind of stuff?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, the reporting that is required under this bill is based on the UPC product-specific information. So to the extent that you are entering a product into the marketplace based on individual kind of SKU information. It is the obligation of the person who's putting it into market to know whether or not they're meeting the reporting requirements and whether the chemicals that are contained in that would apply. And so this is for manufacturers. This is not for, I'm not quite sure what your hypothetical scenario is, but this would be for the people who are making them to begin with.
Maybe I can clear this up a little bit. Did you want to...
Could you speak up a little bit, Representative Yanez?
There are exemptions in the proposed law. And if you look at page 43, line 125-33, is one of the exemptions. And if fewer than 3,000 units of a product or manufactured or distributed annually,
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, one of the things that people may or may not know about me is I used to be a carnival salesman.
Exactly.
And then
you went into politics. Okay, that makes sense.
I thought it was a good segue myself. Step right up. Doesn't only cost a quarter. And there would be semi-tractor loads of some of these toys coming in, all imported from Hong Kong. And where they were manufactured, not sure. Well over 3,000. How do we deal with the people at the state fair, farmers markets, the little county fairs? I have a couple of ethnic grocery stores and super department stores in my district. And they may not be as well-versed in law as the large companies. So how do I deal with those folks?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, what I mentioned is that this is a regulation of the manufacturer, not the retailer. So we're not asking, I was going to use Target, but they probably engage in manufacturing some of their own products potentially. But we're not talking about the retailer who is selling it to the public. We're talking about the person who is supplying the retailer. So the person who is making the product to begin with is the one who's responsible for reporting whether those chemicals are contained in the products they are entering into the stream of commerce that arrives in Minnesota.
So, Mr. Chair, so if it's manufactured in India or Bangladesh or Hong Kong or Vietnam, where many of these toys are manufactured, honestly, it's the obligation of the manufacturer in China or any of those other countries that I mentioned, to report back to here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the supply chain management is obviously complex globally,
right,
and it could be the same product could be sourced from three different factories in three different countries. We don't know where that comes from, but the person or the entity that has a U.S. presence that is entering that product into the stream of commerce in Minnesota is responsible for the supply chain leading up to that. That's how we regulate global manufacturing to begin with. You have the obligation comes back to the person who is bringing it into the United States.
Okay, good.
Mr. Winkler, I thought I was comfortable with everything, and you keep on leading into more questions. To follow up on Representative Mahoney, so I'm not the expert. We've got an expert here, but apparently with toy manufacturing, and just not myself. But if the manufacturer's in China, they're probably going to ship to a distribution center that's not the manufacturer. It might be an agent to the manufacturer, but it's not the manufacturer. So I don't know if that's – I don't have the bill in front of me. I was actually going to look at it over the weekend, not having seen it before. But is that covered in the bill that the distribution center then would be responsible?
Mr. Chair, the answer to your question is not going to be contained explicitly in the bill itself because it's already based in current law. And I would refer back to the phase-out that we've passed and already for bisphenol A. The same, in fact, that even goes further because it's not just reporting. It's saying you can't use that chemical in a product sold in Minnesota. So that's already a well-established commercial regulation that we have in place, that the supply chain is not you know, it's not the responsibility of the Minnesota Department of Commerce to go home to Vietnam to look at the original factory and inspect it to make sure that it's coming in. There is a U.S. Entity that is responsible for managing that supply chain and being responsible to okay, report to Minnesota.
But that's my question. If it's a distribution center independent of the manufacturer in China, is that distribution center considered an agent of the manufacturer and then covered by this legislation, whether it be under federal law or state law or this bill?
Under, Mr. Chairman, under your hypothetical situation, the person who is taking it from its wherever it was first made and entering it into the commerce that is entering Minnesota is responsible for it.
Was that an air freight carrier? That's who's bringing the product in.
Well, not as a legal matter, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, that's why I'm wondering.
I mean, we have, Mr. Chairman, there are contract manufacturers that cover the globe that pick up that source and may even subcontract out, but there is ultimately one market player who is responsible for entering that product into the commerce. I work at a company that sells a food ingredient. We have contract manufacturers that can source this ingredient from various places. As the company that is selling it and to our distribution partners, we are responsible. We are the manufacturer, even though the difference is, I guess, maybe the difference is sort of a lay understanding of manufacturing as being doing the physical work versus the company that's actually responsible for putting the product into the stream of commerce. That ultimately is what the manufacturer is under the law.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, given you've put this legislation forward, I would assume that you're concerned about the Consumer Product Safety Commission's ability to effectively regulate in this area. Can you speak about that? And we've only talked about toys so far, but I know this is much broader. I've heard concerns from the Grocery and Food Manufacturing Association because there's certainly many products that are marketed to children in that arena. Can you just address what some of those concerns that you've heard are? And again, it's my understanding the Obama administration has actually really strengthened the Consumer Products Association. I'll just comment on that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, the specific federal regulatory world that we're talking about is TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act. Mm-hmm. So it's not the Consumer Product Safety Commission. It is the federal law that governs the entry of chemicals into products to begin with and their
Mr.
sale.
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, they come in the form of products. So you can't set, I mean, once you've got a toy, it's really not appropriate to be talking about the chemical because it's already been put into a toy, and that's what the Consumer Product Safety Commission is responsible for, is the actual toy. So don't they work with the information about the Toxic Free Kids Act?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, as I said before, the TSCA law, which regulates the specific chemical components that are contained in the final product that the commission would regulate, that specific regulatory law covering those chemicals is widely and broadly understood to be ineffective and requiring reform. And the industry representatives, consumer advocates, and lots of people will agree that that is in bad need of reform because it does not allow for us to get to the specific chemicals that are of great concern to people and provide knowledge to consumers about whether that is in those individual products or not. That just doesn't exist today. And so while they agree that it needs to change, for 15 years they have talked about that with nothing happening. And that is why you're starting to see states step forward and saying that at least the consumers in our state should not wait for Washington to act. We should allow our consumers to know whether those priority chemicals are contained in the products being sold to use of children or not. And, you know, if at some point the federal legislation were to move forward after 15 years, they obviously could preempt state regulations and they could eliminate this whole line regulatory change by the states. But until the federal government acts, it is absolutely the role of the states to step in and provide consumers with the information that they're looking for.
Mr. Chair, final question is, Can you just tell me your opinion of the job the Consumer Product Safety Commission is doing in making sure the products that get to market are safe?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, I don't have an opinion about that. Okay. My opinion is simply that the Toxic Substances Control Act is ineffective in providing consumers the ultimate information they need to make informed decisions.
Representative Wagenius.
Committee, what chemicals we're actually talking about. I mean, it's a defined list of pretty potent things that we all would recognize. So I think instead of being theoretical, let's talk about lead and et cetera.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, I can't remember the whole list off the top of my head. But words like phthalates and cadmium and lead are certainly things that come
formaldehyde,
bisphenol A are things that come to mind. Those are things that are well known through peer-reviewed research to have detrimental health effects on children, and yet we do not know on a product-by-product basis whether the item that we're picking up to use with a child actually contains those chemicals or not. It's simply not possible to know that under the current regulatory environment in which consumers have to live.
Further,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, my knowledge of this bill is similar to yours, and I think the reason for it is because it's not in this conference committee report and consequently didn't have a hearing in environment policy or in environmental finance, so I never saw the bill before. And I don't think it even had a hearing in the environment policy bill in the House, but I'm not too sure about that. But I keep hearing BPA being mentioned, and did I read somewhere where the FDA just declared that BPA is safe?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, I can't speak to your reading materials, but I would be surprised if a reputable scientific journal would suggest that bisphenol A was safe for children to consume.
Because if what I'm hearing is true, it's pretty interesting that we've outlawed something that now the FDA has determined to be not a threat to people. And so, and the fact that we haven't had hearings on this bill at all in the Senate is also very difficult for us to make an informed decision on it, I think. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, just to be clear, this law or this bill does not ban BPA. BPA is already banned for certain items in Minnesota. This simply requires that the manufacturer inform consumers whether BPA is in the children's product. And if, in the end, the Department of Health determines that it's safe, then it comes off the list and they don't have to report it anymore.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, in terms of the point that Senator Tomasoni was making, just so conference committee members and members of the audience understand that there are several issues that are in this bill that were covered in one body or the other, and the purpose of having some of the authors and a little bit later some of the committee chairs come before us is to provide some balance where maybe one body didn't get the same information that the other did, and so we're going through an educational process here. But my main point, Senator Tomasoni, is that there will be other issues from the Senate side as well that perhaps we have to go through a learning process from the standpoint of the House because we didn't include it in the bill. But that doesn't mean it's a bad initiative to have under consideration from either body, whatever the issue might be.
Representative Mahoney.
I'm not sure how much longer we're going to hear from the author, but it's interesting. The chemicals or the chemical products that you mentioned, lead, cadmium, formaldehyde, we've banned those and many other things. I can't put in lead pipe for water any longer. I can't put formaldehyde has been banned in many building products. We just don't allow it. I would be interested if you or some of the I'm sure if I asked one of the industry representatives of either side of this bill to provide me with a list of the 9 primary chemicals that we're talking about, I could get that could be provided to the committee so that we would all understand what chemicals we're trying to keep away from kids? Because as I read the bill, it's really focused on products that deal with children under the age of 12 that like to chew on things like they do. And so I would like that list of chemicals, because I think I won't go into a job and work where they're burning lead. I won't go into a job where there's formaldehyde in high numbers. I ripped up an old deck because that's what a product they used to use to preserve wood that we had on our decks. And it was not good for us. So I would like to find out what other chemicals I shouldn't be having in my home, much less a home that maybe someday one of my rugrats will bring a grandchild to.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, it's it's early. You don't want to start that yet. Representative Mahoney, the list is simple to provide. I simply don't have it in front of me. In fact, see, that was my cue, and he came up with that. Bisphenol A, cadmium and lead, formaldehyde, phthalates, and there are three of those, and brominated flame retardants, which has names like DECA-BDE and HBCD.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Winkler, when you provide that list to the committee, could you also, well, I'm going to add something to it. I'm going to add, kind of what they do. Oh, you got that too.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I have it right here if the committee would like copies made or just distribute it later.
Other questions for Representative Winkler? Okay, if not, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, members, let's. We've got other similar legislators here who are non-conferees, but I think what I suggest is we had thought we'd go back to the few same or similar we have, and as we did last night, and then get back into a discussion of some of the issues of difference. And I think what we have is entirely, I believe, from within Health and Human Services. Am I correct?
That's the that's the beginning point, yeah. Mr. Chairman, I was wondering maybe just very quickly, because I did mention it earlier, and Senator Tomassoni was out of the room, but we do have that correction that change of a date that we could maybe dispose of. It's Senate Section 9 in Article 4, and we're told by staff Ms. Fontaine can maybe explain what the situation is. It's a correction on the taconite distribution that we dealt with last night.
I forgot about that. So is there somebody who or Mr. Marks?
I was told that Ms. Fontaine.
Ms. Doyle Fontaine?
Or Doyle Fontaine. Yeah, and there is it's just a change in the year, I think. Senator Tomassoni, are you aware of the issue?
Oh, Mr. Chair, members, this was just a technical correction. It referenced these were the technical corrections to the 2013 distribution, and the effective date referenced the 2014 distribution, but the provision should actually have an effective date of the day following final enactment. It was just an error in drafting, and so this is purely technical.
Okay, we're having distributed. It's the A76 amendment. Distributed, everybody? Of the House?
Mr. Bodern, I gave the amendment to Mr. Bodern.
If members have it, we've had the explanation. Senator Tomassoni is moving the A76 76 amendment. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. So if we want to get back to the, we have a new list of same or similar. Has that been distributed? Does everybody have that?
Yep.
Where are we going to have, take us through this?
Okay with everything?
Yeah.
Okay, you got my proxy.
We have
here. Put the cover on.
We did before was just mention the section, and then they came forward.
So, Mr. Chun and Ms. White.
Mr. Chair and members, I guess last night or yesterday, the provisions on non-emergency medical transportation were put on hold. I believe there were a couple of issues that need to be resolved. The Department of Human Services has worked, I guess, with Sue Abdehoden and the groups that she has been representing to resolve these issues. And I guess the A204 amendment would reflect that. And I believe that either has been, that Mr. Bowden has copies of that.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the A204 amendment.
Yes. And Mr. Chair, I guess I can maybe briefly describe the amendment while it's being passed out. What the amendment does is it retains the language on the new modes of transportation, but it would delay implementation and payment for these modes until a new rate structure is developed. It also eliminates some changes to the current payment rate language. It keeps the current payment rate structure. It also would allow variances to be granted only for new providers and new service modes.
Okay, so let's make sure members, I made reference to the same or similar line items. This is the A204 amendment, which Mr. Chun has been describing. This is relative to some of the mental health issues.
So, Mr. Chair and members, now that it's being passed out, what this amendment is doing is it's retaining in the House and Senate language the language setting up new modes of service delivery, but it delays the implementation and payment for these new modes. There are some questions raised about that leading to costs if a change wasn't made there. The amendment also retains the current law or current provisions on payment for non-emergency medical services, because that was another complication that was identified. And then finally, the amendment clarifies that the authority to grant variances from special transportation standards applies only to new providers and service modes.
Okay. Senator Lurie has moved adoption of the A204 amendment. Is there discussion on that? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries.
And, Mr. Chair, the adoption of the amendment, I think, resolves the policy differences between the House and the Senate. There were some technical differences in which staff recommended the House, so the committee could consider just moving the Senate language, since the amendment was drafted to the Senate language. So those would be the Senate sections that are listed. It's Senate Article 18, Sections 49 to 55, Senate Section 79, and Senate Section 81, which is a repealer.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make that motion. I should state as amended then. It would mean we adopted the amendment. Correct, Mr. Chung? Okay, I move the Senate language as amended.
Okay, Representative Carlson's motion in front of us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. So what else? What do you want us to do? What do you say?
It's supposed to have been on last night's list. Skipped over.
Article 22.
had something different than you have here.
It's the same place.
Is it the same? It's the same. Okay. So then you want to start here.
Yep.
So are we on the Article 27 list?
Mr. Chair, I'm prepared to talk about Article 26. It's the North Star Care provision.
That was my next guess.
Okay.
Sure. So, Chair, on the family services.
Yes, Mr. Chair. In Article 26, there are numerous provisions regarding the North Star Care for Children. These are all budget-neutral provisions. The other night, the committee adopted all of the policy provisions. The remaining are budget-neutral provisions, and the staff would suggest, because there is one technical difference, otherwise it's identical language, that if the committee desires to adopt these sections, that they adopt House Sections 13 to 24 and Section 29.
Okay. That would be in addition to those that are listed, or
right here.
Oh, right here. Okay. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I move then the House Sections 13 to 24 and 29.
Okay. We have Representative Carlson's motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't clear, though. We picked up that technical change with that motion then that you were referencing. Is that?
Yes.
Inspired? Okay.
Yeah, it was to take the House.
That's, by taking the House, we picked up the technical. Okay.
Eliminated Columbus business.
Mr. Chair and members, Danielle Pinelli from House Research. I'm here to go through Article 27, the Community First Services and Supports article. And there's one amendment for that article. It's the A-192 amendment.
We could have that distributed.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the A-192 amendment.
This one here.
Mr. Chair and members, the
A-19. Just hold on for 1 second while we have it distributed. I don't think it's gotten around the conference yet. Has it?
If she could speak into the mic a little closer, I think.
Okay, Ms. Pinelli, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, the A-192 amendment makes two changes to the language in Article 27. The first change on page R9 modifies some language in Section 6 that's related to assessment requirements for CFSS. This amendment was requested by DHS, and it represents an agreement between DHS and the stakeholders on this issue. And then the second page on page... The second change on page R22 modifies some language in section 14 that's related to the budget model. And this just adds care coordinators to a list of people the financial management services contractor needs to provide certain information to on a monthly basis.
Okay, Colonel Lori moves adoption of the A-192 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, members, I can go through the list of sections to be adopted. Staff has gone through and made recommendations on the sections where there were technical differences on whether or not the House or the Senate language should be adopted.
Sure, just a moment.
So on page R1, sections 1, 2, and 3 are identical.
I'll move, Mr. Chairman, the House position.
All right. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
I'm probably.
Mr. Chair, members, on pages R1 through R7 is section 4. There were some technical differences, and staff is recommending the Senate language there.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the Senate position.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair and members, on pages R7 and R8 is section 5, and this is identical.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the Senate position. Or House position, excuse me. Yeah, they're identical, so it doesn't make much difference. But.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, members, on pages R8 and R9 is section 6. There were some technical differences, and the staff is recommending the Senate language, and this is also one of the two sections that was amended in the amendment that was just adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the Senate language.
Okay, on that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, members, on pages R9 through R12 are sections 7 and 8. These are identical.
I'll move the House position, Mr. Chairman.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, members, on pages R12 through R17 are sections 9, 10, and 11. There are technical differences here, and the staff is recommending the House language.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the House position, House language.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, members, on pages R17 and R18 is section 12. This is identical.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the House position.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Mr. Chair, members, on pages R18 through R20 is section 13. There were some technical differences here, and the staff is recommending the House language.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the House language.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion carries, I think.
Mr. Chair, members, on pages R21 through R24 is section 14. There are technical differences, and staff is recommending the Senate language.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the Senate language.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, members, on pages R24 through R26 are sections 15 and 16, and these are identical.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the House position.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, members, on page R26 is section 17. There are some technical differences here, and the staff is recommending the House language.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the House language.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, members, on pages R26 through R28 are sections 18 and 19. There are some technical differences here, and staff is recommending the Senate language.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the Senate language.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair and members, on pages R28 and R29 is section 20, and this is identical.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the House position.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair and members, on pages R29 and R30 is section 21. This was a section where there was a little bit of a substantive difference. The Senate had a paragraph that the House did not have that provides an exception to certain training requirements. DHS is okay with this language, and the language came from the provider groups.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the Senate position. That's where the additional paragraph is that everybody is okay with.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's the Senate language.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, members, on pages R30 and R31 are sections 22, 23, and 24, and these sections are identical.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the House position.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed.
Mr. Chair, that closes out Article 27.
All right, thank you. In front of me, one other proposal from Article 25.
20.
Is what you're going to present that to us, I trust?
Did he say 25? I thought it was 8.
Mr. Chair and members, it's actually Article 28. Mr. Bodern has the updated staff side by side.
Okay, let's have that distributed.
And there's also an amendment if you want to do that, the A65 amendment.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, these are provisions in Article House Article 28, the continuing care article, and they're Senate-only provisions with no spreadsheet costs, and they're non-controversial. And they relate to the disability waiver rate setting methodology that was passed last session. They're Section 62 through 70 and Section 78. And what this language does is it modifies the rate-setting methodology that to clarify how rates are calculated, provides guidance to counties in determining the rates, defines terms that were vague or undefined, and requires the commissioner to issue a semiannual report to stakeholders on rates by services by county. And staff would recommend adopting those Senate sections with the A65 technical amendment.
Chair, I'd move the A65 amendment.
Okay. So first of all, we have Senator Lurie's motion on the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And then Senator Lurie moves
Senate sections 62 through 70 and Senate section 78 in Article 28.
And incorporating the amendment. All right. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Okay. So we have.
Good job, Tony.
Do we have all the action items?
Yep, all that.
It's a lot of work.
Okay.
We have more action.
We did that. With it. Okay. Do we have anything else? Okay. So it appears that.
Yes, we're done with the action items from our perspective.
It sounds like we have finished the same or similar.
Senator Johnson was here to present.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Murphy,
but
we don't have
anybody. Well, we have to get him on
the side.
Yeah, well, that's where we're at now. Yeah.
Okay, why don't we alternate House and Senate?
Okay.
Okay, so what we're going to do, members, is we've got some non-conferees who are here, and we're going to alternate House and Senate. I think just because she was here first, that's the only way I can think of. Senator Johnson has been sitting here since before the start. So we'll have Senator Johnson up, and we'll flip a coin between the House members, maybe Representative Seltzer, but Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, alternating House and Senate when Senator Johnson gets up there, that fits in more than one way, yes.
Yeah.
Former House member, for those who may not know her.
Good evening, members, and Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate your giving me the opportunity to talk a little bit about the two provisions that I have in the bill that have not been heard in the House, and that is the vision therapy bill and the school breakfast bill. The vision therapy is a pilot project, and the breakfast program is for kindergartners only, so it's basically, I would say, a pilot project too, because it would, my original bill called for breakfast for every student in the state of Minnesota to be eligible to have a free breakfast. The cost of if we provided breakfast for every student in the state of Minnesota, it would only come to $7,256,000. Seems like an almost unbelievable small amount of money to get that sort of impact on children and their learning. I'm here to tell you that the reason I'm doing this, it reminds me a little bit of this. A story came to my mind as I was listening to the toxic substances bill that you were discussing. And the story is that two teachers from Centennial High School came in to visit my office and talk about issues of education. And because of my passion for trying to deal with what I think is one of our very significant barriers to learning is food, I started talking about the breakfast program. The one of the teachers, a middle school librarian, looked at me and she said, you know, I want to tell you this story. She had a young boy, about 11 years old, who would come to the library every almost every morning, and he was a very voracious reader is what she called him. But she said she sensed that he came there because he felt protected when he was in that situation. He brought back a library book that he had had at home over the weekend, and the librarian noticed that the edges on the book were all chewed up. And she said, did your dog get a hold of that book? And he said, no, he said, I was so hungry. He chewed his book because he was so hungry. There are many children that are close to that. Let's hope that they're not as terribly hungry as he must have been. But in my view, and a lot of people are seeing this now, that food is something that is very critical to children and their learning. The Anoka-Hennepin School District, the largest in the state of Minnesota, has 40 buildings in their district, and each one of them has a food shelf program, a food shelf that's open for the children that need it. They pack backpacks for the children to take home for the weekend because they come back to school on Monday so hungry that that they are not able to listen to the teacher, no matter how wonderful and talented that teacher is. The vision therapy was brought to me again by another teacher from Centennial School District, which is just, I have just a very small portion of Centennial in my district. But she met me at a Education Minnesota event before the beginning of last year's session. And she asked me if I would, and she asked me and Jerry Newton if we would carry a vision therapy bill that Senator Nienau had carried in the previous session but didn't get passed, but he also had a lot of passion for it. And the reason that we picked that one is that, you know, as I don't know if you've had any of the handouts that I brought along passed out to you, but about 1 in 5 of our school-age youth has some kind of vision problems. And many times these children that have vision problems are thought to be in need of special education. They're typically thought of that it might be dyslexia or whatever. And this special education teacher said she found out so many times that the children's real problem was vision. And we have some very personal stories right here within the Capitol of people's children who were not diagnosed with their vision difficulty, And so what we'd like is to have a program that we could start looking at to find out how many children are really not learning because of vision. So that really is a very brief summary, and I don't know if it got distributed again, but a study by the University of Minnesota, this is just about food without talking about the costs of special ed for children with vision problems, but estimated that childhood food security costs our state approximately $642 million annually. Now, I mean, it seems to me that $7 million that would feed our children breakfast for those that need or want it would be a great investment. But I realize the budget issues that we have here, and I think the $569,000 that it takes to allow any kindergartner to have a free lunch or free breakfast would be good. And I think the $500,000 that we would put into the vision therapy problem could be very beneficial in trying to keep children from being put into special education and costing school districts immense amounts of money. So, again, I ask you to consider it, even though it wasn't heard in the House. I have talked to you, Representative Marquardt, about it, and many people have known about my passion for food because in 1993, I introduced my first bill for free breakfast for everybody while I was in the Minnesota House. And we had a three-year pilot program that came back with just amazing information about what difference it makes, but we were unsuccessful in getting it put in place. I'd like to see us begin this. I would like to see us be leaders rather than followers, and I think that's what's going to be happening. We will see that. Non-academic barriers are what we have to look at. It's a very simple, simple thought, but I think it has just great possibilities.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Carlson.
I have a question of Senator Johnson, and that's that I know that some school sites have had breakfast available. I happened to, before I retired from teaching, I taught at a high school that had breakfast available. Can you tell us how this bill for the kindergartners interacts with programs that may currently be available? And I know every site doesn't have one, but when I was looking at the numbers, I'm not sure how the estimated cost interacts with those school sites that may already provide the school lunch.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, I'm assuming that the schools have decided that it's important. Some schools have decided it is an important enough program that they are finding the money to do it through some means. Those schools will benefit because now if this bill passes, their kindergartner, they will get a reimbursement from the state for the children that are in kindergarten that are eating that lunch. But if I could add to that, maybe I think it's your thought that I can speak about this, is that the difference between giving breakfast to everyone and just giving breakfast to those who qualify because of their family financial situation is very, very great and very important for us to think about, because there is a stigma about showing everybody that your family is poor. None of us would want to do that, and the kids are even more, I think, concerned about being picked out as being looked upon, down upon. So it's the idea is giving everybody breakfast, and hopefully as we do it, we will they will have breakfast in their classrooms, because then they are really equals. They're not. It's not like those. Some children go to the lunchroom, some go to the classroom. Everybody will go to the classroom, and it's this grab and go thing that's really, really impressive, where the kids just pick up a plastic bag and take it into their classroom, and they all sit down and eat together, and they become friends. It's like us. When we have meals together, there's camaraderie that's established, and that stigma is what keeps people from participating in those programs, because they 45% of the children who are eligible to receive free breakfast take advantage of it. Now, that's half of the kids who could be, their parents could be, if they're in, they're in low income, so they could use the help with giving their children a nutritious breakfast without having to scrimp along on something else and find food for them at home. But anyway,
yeah, and
Mr. Chair.
Senator, I wasn't meaning to be critical. I was just curious because I know some school districts do offer the breakfast. I'm not sure what the criteria is. I thought the school that I was in received some federal funds, but I retired in 1998, so my memory may be a little faulty, but I know that it was provided either to students generally or to some students. I'd have to think about how
Definite.
That was done. But when the buses would unload, a lot of the students, ours was served in the lunchroom, so a lot of the students that were interested in, qualified, I'm not sure what the criteria was anymore, would go down there and have breakfast.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, any school that if they are at, you know, all of the children who are in the 130% of poverty are eligible for that. However, they have to file for it with the school district, and that sometimes is difficult to get. But some schools, you know, almost like 80% of their kids are in that category of poverty. So at that stage, they do get federal and state money if the children are in poverty. For so schools, and I could name some, and you know, I hate to even do it because again, I hate to label a school as being impoverished.
Mr. Chairman, that answers my question. Then, when you mentioned those sites, and that's federal and state dollars currently, then okay, thank you.
Other questions for Senator Johnson? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Cohen, and I appreciate your listening to me, and I hope that we see the money come through. Thank you.
Thank you. So it turns out so Mary is doesn't want
to. She wants to do it when Tom. When Tom is here. Yeah, okay. and he left for up north, so okay. She's so just sitting in tonight.
Do we have any House members?
Do we have, Nancy, are there any of our House members here tonight to present? I guess that's it then.
Okay. In terms of non-conferees, Senator Latz, you've been here quite a while. Did you want to go ahead, or Senator Kent, you have? All right, so Senator Latz, what would you like to present to us?
Pardon me?
You wanted to present, I think you wanted to present some thoughts in terms of.
Sure. Want me to do it from here or from the table?
Whatever you'd like.
I'll do it from here then, since I'm already set up. Mr. Chairman and members, there are several provisions relating to judiciary and public safety that are in the bill, some out of the Senate side only, some out of the House side only. I'm not going to go into the public safety related stuff like the Office of Justice Policy and so on. Those are part of Senator Dibble's jurisdiction. So I'm just going to identify the ones that came through the Judiciary a Committee process on the Senate side. And I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that this committee has already adopted the default misdemeanor language. If that's correct, unless there are questions, I will not go into that.
Yeah, we've adopted that.
Adopted it.
Okay. And members, with regard to the expungement provisions that are in the bill, the Senate was carrying the funding for the expungement bill, but the policy language traveled separately and is presently on the Senate's general orders on the floor. It has not been taken up by the full Senate yet. I understand the House not only carried the funding, but that the language of the entire expungement bill was incorporated into this budget bill. on the House side. And, you know, Senator Champion is carrying that bill on the Senate side. And I guess I will simply encourage the members to adopt. I'm not sure what Senator Champion wants to do or what the advocates want to do as stakeholders in terms of utilizing the supplemental budget process for the adoption of that bill or whether it'll be traveling separately. My understanding is it might be up on the Senate floor on Monday. Or maybe there's some others that could correct me on that. But it is a result of, well, many years of discussion, and in particular since last spring, a large stakeholder group that worked very hard to put together what is, I believe, mostly, if not entirely, a consensus approach to expungement that is part of the broader second chance efforts in the legislature. And the goal, of course, is to give those who have faced criminal charges, whether it's separately and whether it's resolved by a dismissal or whether it's resolved by a conviction. Yes, Senator.
Senator Lance, actually, I don't think either bill has the language in our bills.
Mr. Chairman, the expungement was carried by Representative Moline in a separate bill. So
side by side that I had in Article 7 had appeared to have the full expungement language in it, and that's what I was informed as well. I may be wrong.
We're getting a signal, Mr. Chairman. What? It's in Article 7.
Mr. Chair, it may be in the side by side, but the language was not in House File 3172. It passed separately in the House. I know we pulled the money into this comparison because the Senate had the money in, and so we pulled the House money in here. Maybe the House language got in here, too. I don't know.
But it did pass the House, Mr. Chairman, as a separate bill.
All right. Mr. Chairman, the copy I have of the side-by-side page R17-A7 has looks to me to have most, if not all, of the expungement language in it. That runs through R20. R29. So I'm told the reviser may have made a decision to pull all the policy language into the bill. I'm not sure what the genesis was, and I'm happy to forego discussion of it.
If the bill's going separately, both House and Senate, and we don't have the language to determine this conference committee, then we should let the ARPA process proceed. Representative Mahoney, you want to, what, your discussion about the money, as to what the money's going
we
for?
We probably need to know about is just what the cost is.
The cost is? Senator Latz?
So, Mr. Chairman and members, the Department of Public Safety cost is $600,000 per year. The Department of Human Services has $98,000 per year, but that would be offset by some federal revenue of $34,000 per year. So the total expense in the general fund would be $664,000 per year.
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, members, before the bill separate expungement bill passed on the House floor, we had a new fiscal note from the Department of Public Safety that I believe the number was $473,000 in fiscal 15 and $582,000 in 16 and 17. That never got amended in the House bill, but that was the latest fiscal note on it. So there may be an opportunity to lower the appropriation in this area, too. From the one that's the same in both the House and Senate.
And I note for the record, Mr. Walls is nodding his head, so we've got confirmation. So, any other questions about the Representative Mahoney? Oh, you look like you had a question.
Okay,
Senator Latz, if you wanted to proceed with other sections you might want to discuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are provisions in the House relating to disclosure of the location of sex offenders when they're released from custody to the victims. There are some relatively minor differences between the two bodies, and I don't know if you want to go into detail on specifics at this time or not. But the whole idea is that, in particular for victims of sex offenses, when the convicted defendant is done serving their time, the victims wanted to know when they were being released, and so they could take appropriate precautions if they felt it was necessary to do so. That was a theory, and there is a separate Senate bill on that, and I believe that's on the Senate floor as well. Did members wish to go into any detail on that? Or?
Members have questions?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, there is another set of languages in the House side only. The Senate bill is also on the Senate floor on general orders, having to do with enhancing fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct offenses under certain circumstances. There are a number of substantial differences between the House and the Senate, and the stakeholders are presently attempting to work out those differences. So I would anticipate at some point that there'll be an agreement, a consensus on that. But the idea is that for certain repeat sex offenders, mostly at a felony level, that there be some penalty enhancements available to them. It would bump up gross misdemeanors to felonies under certain circumstances. And there was discussion about the look-back period and about relative maximum penalties and probationary periods, and precisely what kind of predicate offenses would be used to enhance a new offense to a felony level. And those are the kind of discussions that are going on. But there was general agreement that it was appropriate and a consensus that it was appropriate to go ahead and enhance certain offenses of this nature to felony level, fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct offenses. The details, as I say, are being worked out by the stakeholders. Mr. Chairman, I also understand there was a Senate provision that's already been adopted by this committee having to do with lengthening the continuation for juvenile.
We did that last night.
Okay. So I won't go into that. And then, Mr. Chairman, the only remaining provision, I'm sorry, there's a post board transfer that I think might already have been adopted as well. I have my notes that it was the same or similar situation. They needed an extension of some time to expend certain funds, as I recall, because it wasn't all expended within, expendable within this fiscal, the deadline that was set in legislation in the past. So maybe someone can tell me if that's been adopted.
It's not.
Nope. Okay. Does anyone want any specific detail on that? It was a non-controversial item. The post board came in requesting the continuing authority to expend the funds for training purposes. It had to do with sex trafficking training.
Representative Carlson.
I was just going to say, Senator Latz, mainly what we were adopting were issues that didn't have a revenue impact. We're still waiting for the framework for the resources the committee will have. So some of the issues that have a cost ramification will be discussed later or taken up later.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, this particular provision didn't involve expenditures of any new money. It was simply authorizing the expenditure of already appropriated funds, the authorization of which would have expired were it not for this legislation.
Right. And that was legislation carried by myself and Representative Paymar.
I believe that's correct. I'll mention that as well. So, I mean, if you, whenever you get to it, it's fine, whether you address it now or somewhere down the road. It's fine.
Okay.
The chairman can explain that very well.
Do members have any questions for Senator Latz?
I had one other item as Mr. Chairman. There is a provision that was, amended on the Senate floor having to do with a study of the costs of private prisons. Senator Westrom had added an amendment on the Senate floor to provide for that study. It was not part of the original bill that came out. So I guess I'll leave it up to the members how you want to handle that. There was, the issue has been ongoing. The study is purported to look only at costs, including capital costs. There is at least one school of thought that it might be nice just to put this whole issue to rest and have the Department of Public Safety take, or Corrections rather, take a look at it sort of resolve it. But there have been studies in the past, and this particular study was kind of limited to cost, but there's a lot more to the issue of private prisons beyond the question of cost, including effectiveness, recidivism rates, safety, and including some errors in the past regarding inappropriate releases. There's a broad issue here. I'll just say the Senate added it without any great controversy, but I think some of the stakeholders or advocates have some concerns about that. And when the time comes up, you may wish to hear from them.
There's a lot of things we'd love to put to rest around here.
Okay.
Maybe not in this bill.
Any questions for Senator Latz? Great. Thank you. And obviously,
thank you.
Representative Carlson, you can follow up with Representative Paymar on Monday. And if he has any other comments, if he has comments he'd like to offer on the House sections, obviously happy to do that.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I just to comment, I've had conversations with Representative Paymar, and he has requested an opportunity to do something similar to what Senator Latz did. So we'll... I can work with Representative Paymar to find the time that works.
Thank you. And I'll note, I have talked with Representative Paymar as well about this bill.
Okay. All right.
No great conflict between us over it either.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Laurie.
Before we move on to another topic, real quick, I wonder if you would entertain, when we adopted the North Star Care for Children in Article 26, there was one identical provision, revisor's instruction to change the name guardian assistant and all references to North Star kinship assistance that should have been adopted at that same time. It was House Section 28 of Article 26, if you'd entertain it.
All right, Ms. White's indicating that's correct. So Senator Laurie makes that motion.
I move we adopt House Section 28 and Article 26.
Okay. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Kent, would you like to join us? And you have a section,
I think
in the education bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about a provision that I have in the Senate education bill. It's one of those it seems small, but then that worries us that it might get overlooked because it seems small. It is a small but very important step in a larger process. This kind of goes back to some of the issues that Senator Johnson was speaking of in terms of some of the non-academic education issues that have academic consequences as well as other consequences for students. And this one is a PE survey. This bill instructed the Minnesota Department of Education to report on K-12 students' experience with physical education and physical activity. It asks the department to do a survey. It's part of a process. Back in 2010, the legislature adopted PE standards from the National Association for Sport and Physical Education. This is a very important step for Minnesota's kids, but we all know the importance of monitoring and ensuring effective implementation. And so by asking the department to conduct this brief survey of districts around the state, we would get a good snapshot of where students stand right now in terms of both physical education and physical activity, not just PE class, but other types of activity that they're doing during the day. And this is important for several reasons. First of all, PE, when done well, and that is what these new standards do, it is a newer approach to physical education. It gives students lifelong skills that they can take with them for the rest of their lives to try to instill healthy habits, which obviously we all understand is important for a lot of reasons. It also, research really shows us that when we have kids moving during the day, they learn better. They're able to focus, their bodies work better, their minds work better, and there is strong academic results associated with solid activity and PE during the school day. So this just continues a process. We implemented these new standards. Now we're asking to do a study to see where we stand, and then once we have that information, that'll give us an idea if there are things that the department wants to do. The department supports this. It's a modest effort, but it is an important step in a long-term process. I would just also add that this is supported by a substantial coalition of Minnesotans for Healthy Kids, everybody from the American Heart Association to the Minnesota Cancer Alliance and the American Cancer Society, any number of well-known organizations that look out for the health of our children. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Kent? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Members, I've been, you know, what Representative Carlson and I talked about doing was to ask the staff to put together some of the differences and give members a chance to discuss them. And I don't want to, and then I think Ms. Connolly and Ms. Scholes posted some of the areas to be discussed. And, you know, pretty nice day, I guess. And so we don't have a lot of members here. So, Senator Tomasoni, and these were differences between the House and the Senate to allow some discussion. So, Senator Tomasoni, to be honest, I think about it in terms of conferees who have, at least the list I have in front of me, can I just ask you about some of the sections and you can just address them?
If you, my staff's here, yeah, that'd be a good idea.
Be a good idea to ask you, have you discussed them, or
if the
good
staff,
idea to have the staff here?
It would be better to have the staff here before we discuss it in case I give you the wrong answer. But go ahead.
I've got a list.
I could probably help you out with your bill.
Well, I would like you to help me out with my bill.
But you had an appropriation for some of the housing challenge grants for the colleges.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you'd like to say about that?
Well, are you talking about the $3.1
million? Yeah.
Yeah. There's a couple of colleges in northern Minnesota, one in Thief River and one in Ely, the Vermilion College. Both are in the process of trying to do some housing for their campuses, and they just need some financial help in order to be able to build the housing. And we've heard from both of them that it's extremely important because of the location in order to be able to provide housing for students, so that when students come to places like Ely, for example, because they want to experience the not only what the college offers but what they're learning as a result of where the college is, that they have a place to house the students also. And so and the Thief River also has a very unique aviation program where they have in a similar situation where they need housing for students. And so this is a program where both of these campuses are singled out as possible recipients of this housing money so that they can actually build some on-campus dorms.
You also had an appropriation for the Greater Minnesota Business Development Grants.
And those, that's the $4.5 million you're talking about?
Yes.
And those, Mr. Chairman, are rural, it's a rural program, and each of those cities that are listed in that particular subsection are places that have business parks that are targeted for development and for businesses, and so they're on the list of places that get some money.
Okay. And I'm just kind of going down a list that I have. This is all in the economic development area. The next is the repayment of the 21st Century Mineral Fund. There's $5 million.
I can give you the history.
I know this one's difficult for you, Senator Tomasoni. Maybe I should give it a try. There's an appropriation for the 21st Century Minerals Fund, and members might recall that Governor Plenty had unallotted the entirety of the 21st Century Fund, and it's something that's been utilized for a number of purposes in northeastern Minnesota. And I want to make it clear, Senator Thomas Sonoy didn't want to do anything with this. I was insistent that we include as much money as possible. Senator Thomas Sonoy came to me, and he was pretty self-effacing about it, I think. Am I misstating that? I think that you really didn't want to push this too hard. You felt a little bit reticent, and I encouraged you to ask for as much as you could for the 21st Century Minerals Fund.
And I think that's pretty accurate.
So this is Senator Thomas Sonoy was pretty quiet about this.
Senator Thomas Sonoy being bashful?
Well, about this particular.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and to add a little bit to it, because you were the one who made me aware of this, is that this is the only fund that was tapped by previous administrations for budget balancing that hasn't been paid back in its entirety, and that it's about time we do it, especially in light of some of the things that are going on in regards to the minerals and developments on the Iron Age. So
I just want the House conferees to understand that Senator Thomas only, like I said, was really reluctant about this, and he didn't want to push too far. Is what he told me.
Well, and
Senator Thomas?
You should point out also that there's only $5 million in the bill, and that actually the fund is owed $24.5 million. So the rest of it is used. I think this is the mechanism that you came up with, Mr. Chairman, that was used to pay back the fireman's suspense account as well as the airport account, and that was to automatically pay it back in the event of a budget surplus, and so the rest of it is in that particular form.
And to be fair, that was language. The kidding aside, that was language that Senator Skoy and I put together relative to the repayment to model it after some of the other parts of the statute where we've provided for automatic repayment.
But Mr. Chairman, I should also point out that now that it's in the bill, I'm very passionate about it.
Well, in your self-effacing way. And obviously, Representative Mahoney, you're going to be familiar with a lot of this. We have an appropriation against Senator Thomas on the workforce development grants, which obviously you've dealt with extensively.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Nauman.
So, Mr. Chairman, if members are seeking out the language.
I can't really hear you.
My apologies, Representative. I just wanted to point out for members the language that Senators Cohen and Thomasoni are speaking about that does the automatic buyback to fill the remaining $19.1 million is in Article 3 of the House bill, but the side-by-side has it on page R20 at the bottom, line 124.7, continuing through 124.20. And essentially, if there is a surplus in the November forecast, 20% of that surplus will be allocated to refill the 21st Century Mineral Fund or $19.1 million, whichever is less.
Mr. Representative, Senator Cohen, it seems that, I'm not sure whether I should ask you or Senator Thomasoni, but do you have any of the history on the 21st Century Mineral Fund, how it came into being?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Mahoney, this goes back to the days of when Doug Johnson was, I believe, the tax chairman in the Senate, and there were two different appropriations of $30 million from the general fund to the 21st Century Minerals Fund, and it was my understanding at the time that it was done as a substitution for potential bonding projects that may have been done in northeastern Minnesota. So ultimately what ended up happening was the money was initially used to fund the Mesabi Nugget project, which was a demonstration project at the time. And there is now a nugget plant in commercial size that's in operation at the site of the old LTV plant. on the by the pit of the old LTV site, I should say. In 2003 and in 2004, of the $60 million that was in the fund, Governor Pawlenty unallotted, I think, $51.5 million, of which over the next 10 years, the legislature replenished one payment of $14.9 million and another payment of $11 million. And so the calculation has been that what's owed to the fund since the $51.5 million was unallotted is this $24.1 million that's in this bill.
Okay, and Senator Tomasoni, there are some other sections of your article. The community.
Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry, Representative Mahoney.
Should we ask questions about any of the other things that have already come up? Or?
Sure, if you'd like to. Sure.
I'd like to actually ask Senator Tomasoni about the $4.5 million for Greater Minnesota infrastructure grants. Typically, that's a bonding project dollar in a bonding year, or at least it has been for most of the years that I've been here. And we typically don't call out projects in it. So is there some reason or logic to doing cash in a bonding year and calling out five cities, I think north of St. Cloud?
Well, in my mind, there is.
Well, maybe you can help us all out.
Well, I think I explained it already that there's projects in each one of these cities that are business development projects that will ultimately provide the infrastructure for businesses to create jobs in these cities, and so this is the economic development bill. And I've been urged by my colleagues to do this in this particular bill. And I think these are all very meritorious projects, and they all will result in rural Minnesota areas that need business development to provide the infrastructure for some of the businesses that we're thinking about being able to put in place. And each of the places has a business in mind. So. I think in the case of Thief River Falls, it's got something to do with the Sanford Health System also. So it's a big, big company that's going in there.
Chairman Cohen, I've gotten numerous phone calls from around the state wondering why this change was made, because the history of it is that there's a process that they go through and they have an evaluation. So and once I started getting those phone calls, I actually called up to a number of the cities that were talked to. So this is something that's probably going to profile around the state. So it might be something we might want to dig into pretty deep before we start calling out names of which city it goes to.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, I understand that, Representative Mahoney. I'm very comfortable that what each of these cities has in place is. They deserve to have the money as a result of the parameters under this particular provision in the bill. And whether it's cash or bonding, it seems to me if we were to do this in the form of cash, it's actually cheaper for the state of Minnesota than to do it in the form of bonding. And it does help one of the biggest problems with infrastructure in rural Minnesota is that the tax base is so low that it's very difficult for them to come up with money to pay for these projects, which is why we have particular programs like this. And getting economic development in the far reaches of rural Minnesota is also very, very difficult. And so we actually formed a committee a number of years ago of transportation experts, and the focus of the committee was to try and figure out why it was so difficult to get manufacturers to come out to northern Minnesota because of the one constant that we always heard was that the transportation costs were too high because of the distance that they had to travel. And so all the transportation experts that were on this committee all talked for about an hour, and when it was all said and done, they all came to the conclusion that there was nothing they could do about the location because that's where we lived. And so the transportation costs were going to be the transportation costs. So if we don't help out with things like infrastructure to provide some incentive for these places, to these businesses to move there, we have a very, very hard time recruiting businesses.
Mr. Chair. And so, Senator Tomassoni, of the $4.5 million, is that equally divided, or is there a
I think each one
of these cities has a $900,000 project?
I think each one of the cities has a request, and I can get you the numbers.
Yeah. And Representative Mahoney, Mr. Nauman reminded me that when we had a discussion on this earlier, relative to the discussion of bonding versus non-bonding, that in many instances you're dealing with a private entity which would not be non-bondable then. It wouldn't be a public entity. So obviously, as all of us know, to bond, you need the public entity to have the fee ownership and whatever the property is.
Well, Senator Cohen, I hate to correct you, but it's public infrastructure money, and public infrastructure money is roads, sewers, water, and electricity, and those are all bondable projects, even for a private entity, because you're serving to a private entity through a municipal entity.
Well, I don't think it was Mr. Mueller who offered that advice. I don't think he's here, but it was my understanding that that's, some of this was not bondable.
That was part of what we understood too.
But we can have that discussion.
I'm sure your staff will be able to provide that, the items in each particular project that aren't bondable, because I've been doing this for 15 years, about as long as not quite as long as Senator Tomassoni, and we'll take a look at them. We'll take a look at them.
Okay. Well, we'll have a chance to, again, talk to Mr. Nauman. We think that's what I've articulated is the correct position, but that's something we can determine and make sure as this thing proceeds that we get some further information. Sir Tomassoni, I hate to put you on the spot, but...
now or never, or later.
So I'm just kind of going down the list in terms of some of the differences. You had some an appropriation for some of the alternative energy projects. And again, members, what I'm doing is not going through everything. In the absence of House or Senate authors, I'm just simply looking for the people who are present. So we can have some of these issues laid out.
Mr. Chairman, this one's not jumping out at me. Oh, okay. This is actually related to the 21st Century Minerals Fund, Mr. Chairman, and we may have to fix that language up. It's in reference to a 2009 use of the 21st Century Minerals Fund. If my memory serves me correctly, what happened here was that DEED allowed the IRRRB to use a portion of the money, and the money hasn't all been used. And the request from the IRRRB has been to expand the potential use of the money to bio-based products. And so this is an attempt to allow that particular appropriation to be used for more than what it was originally intended for.
Okay. And you have a couple of others. Some of the...
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
What's the project, Senator Tomassoni?
The bio-based project?
Yes.
Is that what you want to know? This is the... A company that is making a cellulosic product either from and needs the sugar.
Yeah, here you, Senator Thompson.
It needs the sugar that is produced from either corn or wood manufacturers. And then the name of the company is Sagetis, and the IRRRB has entered into an agreement with them to fund the building of a commercial sized plant on the Iron Range, and part of the funding would come from that particular fund.
If I might, Mr. Chair, the 21st, the IRRRB entered an agreement for, is it 21.2 or 22.1 million?
21, yeah.
Was that a loan? Do you know?
Yes, it would be a loan.
So would the 21st Century Mineral Fund money that you're redirecting, would that be a loan or would that be a grant?
It would be paid back, is my understanding.
It would be paid back?
It would be my understanding, yeah. If I'm wrong, I'll let you know that, okay?
So that particular
the entire funding of this would be a loan. I'm not sure that we have a forgivable loan in place anywhere, but it's possible that after the
yes, that's the interesting part.
I don't remember anything in the package that said that if they produce a certain number of jobs or are there for a certain amount of time, the loan would be forgiven. It's my understanding that it would all be paid back, and that there's. There's some significant collateral of the company's current assets in the event that something doesn't go the way we were hoping it goes.
Yes, I'm pretty sure I understand what you mean by that, but the Sagetis plant has how many employees in it?
Currently?
Well, projected.
Projected?
Projected at the plant.
They're projecting 50 direct jobs. They're projecting another 140 indirect jobs and even 230 more in the conversion of wood. The total that I have seen is upwards around 600 jobs that will be affected by this particular technology. I think, and every single one of us is pretty convinced of this, that this is definitely a high risk thing. They're going from the pilot plant stage right now to the commercial stage, and they have a patent on a molecule that is above my understanding, but it's apparently something that we are looking to for plastics in the future, a substitute for petroleum products, and the cellulosic sugars that they'll be using are currently going to be coming from corn-based sugars. The intent is to go to wood-based products so that we can actually utilize the forestry industry on the Iron Range also. So we are very aware of the fact that it's a high-risk venture, but there's an awful lot of what's going on out in the world that appears to be pointing toward this to be widely used in the future.
And then finally, you had an appropriation for employment services for persons who were. Before we get to that, I want to revert back to this question of what's bondable or not. Mr. Nauman had consulted with Mr. Mueller.
So, Mr. Chairman and members, to the representative's question from earlier. The language in the Senate bill on, I'm now in Article 3, but language on page R6 on the Senate side, this is that $4.5 million appropriation for the Greater Minnesota Business Development and Public Infrastructure Grant Program, which is governed by statute section 116J.431. And under that statute, it lists eligible projects that cities and counties may apply for to include manufacturing, technology, warehousing, distribution, research development, agriculture, processing. Certainly, it seems like there might be some public infrastructure aspects to that that would be bondable, but I could also see a circumstance where, based on that list, there might be some private side aspect of this as well. So it's sort of a blend, and I think I'm sure the Senate was thinking that because it's a blend, direct appropriation as opposed to non-bonding dollars might be more appropriate to meet the needs of this particular project.
Would you like my response to that?
Sure.
All of those particulars are the premise for that particular language is set up to provide infrastructure grants to build sewer, water, traffic systems, and things such as that. Now, if you proceed with that particular language in that particular field of thought, you open up this, we may as well stop calling it the infrastructure grant program, because this opens a Pandora's box. And this would be something that you probably want the Department of Employment and Economic Development and their business development group to come in and have a small conversation about before we move forward on this. But I'm pretty sure if we open this box, we'll never close it again.
Okay. Well, as we proceed, we can certainly make sure we have agencies available to offer some direction. Senator Thomas, when you'll ask, as I started to mention, you had an appropriation for employment services for persons who are deaf or hard of hearing. Do you call that appropriation?
Is there an appropriation?
I don't think there's an appropriation.
It's not an appropriation. The language.
And there could potentially be some tails there, Mr. Chairman, but I don't. I haven't been made aware of that as of this point in time, from what I can tell.
Okay. So.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mahoney.
The tails on that are approximately $2.4 million a biennium.
Okay.
Give or take a couple hundred thousand.
I'm not sure where Representative Mahoney got that number, but I haven't been told of that yet. So you can just fill me in later, I suppose.
Okay, then I just thought, again, we don't have a lot of members here. I thought I might address a couple of issues that I've been involved with. And the first is, and because Representative Mahoney, I think when we were going through the side-by-sides, we talked about the Office of Regenerative Medicine. And that actually was Representative Murphy's legislation, I believe. And so maybe I should be a little bit hesitant. I'm not going to speak, obviously, for Representative Murphy. But I was involved with the Senate approach pretty heavily. Senator Sieben was actually the author of the bill, but it was a combination of Senator Sieben, Senator Bonhoff, and myself. And what's in the Senate bill is simply a grant to Mayo and the University of Minnesota. It was my understanding from talking to both Dr. Terzak from Mayo and Dr. Toller from the U that what they were looking for was to have some state involvement. Obviously, the money that's in the Senate bill, which is $5 million, and money in the tails as well, is going to come it's nowhere close to what you'll need to do some of the significant research. I found it pretty exciting to talk to these doctors. I think it was Dr. Terzak who made the comment when he was in my office that as doctors, we do a very good job of treating symptoms, but we don't do a very good job of actually curing people, and that regenerative medicine was the next threshold of medicine where they would actually try to seek cures for some significant diseases. And it was my understanding that they were looking for was to show state involvement, state financial involvement, relative to the research being done at Mayo and the university to help facilitate NIH grants, other kinds of monies coming in for research. It was also my understanding that the combination of Mayo and the U is fairly far advanced in terms of where this is, certainly on a national basis, if not a worldwide basis. And so the Senate position was to provide money for that purpose. And to do it with what, in the context of this bill, is a sizable grant, but in the context of what will be required is not sizable. But again, it was my understanding that they're not looking to have hundreds of millions of dollars put into this for state for the research purposes of state dollars, but to at least show that the state of Minnesota is a participant and a partner. So that's kind of the distinction from the Senate perspective that I wanted to offer. The other issue, but I think House members have probably listened to some debate on this and have some sense of it because there's language in both bills relative to the general issue. The other thing that I was going to note was something in higher education, although that was not an article posted. I just thought I'd take advantage of the fact that there aren't a lot of people here in terms of legislators. I've gotten involved, and there are many of us who have done this, both House and Senate, in achievement gap legislation. I'll bet there's no disagreement in this room that the achievement gap is both a state disgrace and a national disgrace. And Representative Marquardt, you've obviously dealt with the attempt to deal with achievement gap issues in some detail on your division, I bet. But I put together a more eclectic combination of achievement gap issues. One of the issues I was involved with were the scholarship monies, and Senator Franson was the person very involved with that, so I wanted to wait till she was available. I wanted to just discuss something that's not in the House bill, and I think an issue that probably has not been presented to the House. But one of the concerns as I got into this was that we concentrate on the front end, and putting aside achievement gap concerns directly, you know, we look at ECFE, we look at early childhood education, scholarships, and we talk about obviously the need to get to grab kids at the front end, and particularly kids in terms of the achievement gap, kids who are in a tougher situation. Again, Representative Marquardt, I'm obviously not saying anything that you haven't heard hundreds and hundreds of times, but what is a little bit different is in some of the work I was doing, it was clear that at the back end, the high school end, you have some of the same problems, that you have kids who are not prepared to go on to higher education, and that even if you have good counseling services within a school, there is some enhanced need to deal with kids who just have been in a more disadvantageous situation. And there's a program in town called College Possible, and I don't know, Representative Marquardt, has that? Okay. It's a remarkable program that is actually a mentoring program, and it sets up young adults to work with kids who are in the process of going to some kind of a post-secondary institution, and to have them better prepared for going to a campus where, you know, they'll have some background from high school, but they're not going to be quite up to the ability of kids who, again, are in a better situation. And so kids who through no fault of their own, just need that extra enhanced help. It's set up as a mentoring service. It's been quite successful. And I think the program has serviced several thousand, I'm not sure, don't hold me to that number, kids in the Twin Cities. And again, it relates to families where you're dealing with the poverty levels. It's not available to everybody. What they'd like to do is to be able to expand the program and to expand the program, particularly into rural Minnesota, which is untouched. And so there's a grant in the higher education article that provides for that help. And when I came across it, and I'll be honest, I originally came across the program through a newspaper story and proceeded to take a closer look at it. And I think it provides some support for, again, the back end that we really haven't talked about. And I should also add that this program then follows the kids, tracks the kids, and spends time with the kids as they proceed through their post-secondary experience. And the program is, I think it's been around for maybe 10-plus years or so. And so they've had some experience in terms of tracking these kids, and it's demonstrated some relatively remarkable success. And so that's an appropriation that I'd make a pitch for. That's something that I authored myself. And some of the other things I have in terms of the achievement gap are authored with other senators. So I think, and Senator Wigger's not here, we'll get into a larger discussion. Again, we don't have the other senators here, but certainly there's a significant element of the Senate bill that deals with early childhood kinds of issues, the scholarships, the ECFE, early childhood readiness, and also somewhat related, the English learner language. And obviously, Representative Marquardt, you're very conversant with all of this. So those were a couple of pitches on some stuff that I've been involved with on the Senate side. So, Mark.
Thank you. Well, Senator Cohen, I really appreciate those comments because you're right on with that. And I have to say, with Senator Wieger and what the Senate and the House and the governor did last year on really seriously tackling that achievement gap. I mean, you know, it is a disgrace. And I also think that the achievement gap is our number one threat to the viability of our future economy. There's no doubt about it, and the stats will show that. So I agree, and I think, the efforts early on like we did last year with a lot into the early learning stuff, we're starting to look at, even in the world's best workforce now, one of those goals are to be college and career ready, as you just mentioned, Senator Cohen. So I really appreciate what you had to say there. And I just think this legislature should be commended for actually last year, I think for the first time in a long time, saying the achievement gap is unacceptable, as you just said. And I think we all here made some really, really good progress on actually moving forward on that issue.
Well, and I'd agree, because, I mean, you did some great work last year in your division and in the E-12 article on a variety of levels with early childhood and in particular, as you suggest, addressing some of the achievement gap for the first time. I've tried to look at it from a couple of different angles. In fact, it's on this list. Let me. We said we wouldn't stay here late, but I'll. And there's really nobody else. I'm looking through these lists that staff put together, and a lot of these legislators are not here. But I guess I'll take the opportunity to address, because I just realized it's not on the list, but another smaller appropriation that's in the Senate bill. And you're going to have to allow me a little bit of context. It happens to be an arts deal. Not surprising that I would be involved. But I want to explain the program because it's a striking program, and I need to kind of offer the context. Okay, so several years ago, and Senator Tomasoni's heard this story, but I think it was in November 2009, the president appointed me to what's called the President's Committee on the Arts and the Humanities. There are about 35 of us from around, not really from around the country. It's very heavy, New York, Washington, L.A. There are about 8 of us from elsewhere, and people will appreciate that I shout about geographic diversity. We meet several times a year in Washington. It was a committee set up during the first year of the Reagan presidency, and it was determined that the First Lady would be the honorary chair. So Mrs. Obama is the honorary chair of our committee, and we have some involvement with her. The committee is advisory to the White House, but there's a program that was established by the committee called the Turnaround Arts Program. And the attempt was to integrate an arts curriculum into the regular school curriculum. And what the committee did was to, and what I learned in being on this committee was, I'm not really a legislator, it's kind of a board of directors. So what the staff did was to send some kind of an application or a letter to all the SIG schools in the country, as identified by the federal department, to see what kind of response they would get. So you're talking about, as you well know, the toughest schools in the United States. And I think they cut it down to about 15 to 20 and then made site visits to X number of schools and selected 8 schools. The President and First Lady wanted to put some serious artists on this committee, and each of the artists on the committee adopted a school. And we're talking about the school in Portland, Des Moines, Boston, Hartford, New Orleans, the Lame Deer Reservation in Montana, and I'm missing a couple, I think. And there's a school in D.C., the Savoy School in the Anacostia neighborhood. And so we've gone to that school a couple of times, and it's really remarkable. And first time we went there, our executive director on the van said half the fathers were in jail or prison from the school. What the attempt was to then see what kind of metrics could be established with these schools. And there was some work done with the Booz Hamilton outfit in the University of Chicago. Significant increases in achievement scores, significant increases in attendance and significant decreases in disciplinary problems. On a subjective basis, without the kind of metrics established, we've talked to three of the principals, and a huge increase in parental and family involvement. So I thought, okay, this is a great idea. How about if we try to do something here? In the process, so now I'm coming to the appropriation, in the process, they have begun, committee's begun phase two, and they've made site visits to 15 places. Minnesota put in an application, and to be honest, at my encouragement, it's a joint venture between the Purpich School and the State Arts Board, and the attempt was, in terms of the Minnesota application, to take a step further. And so the proposal was for four schools, because usually the applicants for both phase one and phase two were coming out of individual school districts. But a school in Minneapolis, a school in St. Paul, a rural school, and one of the northern reservations. And the final determination has not been made. I'm very optimistic Minnesota will be selected. So there is a contingent small appropriation to provide some of the cost if Minnesota is selected, and I wish we would know that by the end of the session. Although if we go to the constitutional deadline, we'll probably know, because I think the announcement is coming out of the White House on May 20th. So at any rate, that's the other appropriation. And pardon? It's $600,000 for the State Arts Board. But again, it's a joint venture, and so I made proposed the appropriation to the Arts Board. And from talking to the staff, I think they were very impressed with the site visit they made here, which was, I think, in early February. So.
And Senator, what was the grant application for from the federal government? Do you know what the grant application was for? Or how much would be the money coming from the feds?
Good question. They're putting together monies, particularly for phase two, from a variety of sources. There's, I think, and I'm not quite sure, we met in November and got some of the description. There was a conference call, and I'm not sure what's happened since then. The conference call was middle of February. There's $2 million from the Department of Education, I believe. There are a couple of significant foundation grants. There's quite a bit of in-kind support from places like Crayola and National Music something. And I apologize for being a little bit vague on this. So it's a combination then of state or district involvement. And I believe the only other state where there was a state application was California. I think their applications were coming mostly from school districts, and I think out of Chicago from a foundation, I believe. And again, I'm not certain as to what the final selection is. I'm pretty optimistic from what I've heard from the staff, but that's not known exactly. So a little bit longer than I had hoped, but.
Quick question. I was quite involved years ago with when we established the high school for the arts, the Purpich Center. And it has, as you may remember, a dual mission. There's the high school, but then there's also the outreach part of it, where they're to work with the various school districts across the state and help them develop curriculum and so on. And so when you mentioned the Purpich Center, and going another step, are you building on that outreach then, or I'm just trying to figure out what the tie is from what we've already established that's been quite successful, as I understand it.
And Representative Marquardt's going to be aware that the Purpich School has done something, but it's not quite the same. And they've worked with a couple of school districts. I think Fergus Falls is one. Whatever that independent school district is in Fergus, there's another place. So it's not dissimilar, but this is a little bit more directed. And I know when I spoke to the people at Perpich, they were pretty enthused about trying to do this. And to be honest, that's why I suggested before phase two started this thing, I was interested in possibly doing something just on our own in Minnesota, modeling it after what I've seen. The program has been pretty remarkable. What we probably don't get if Minnesota is selected is we don't get the artists, because there are about eight of them, and they, you know.
Well,
I think,
Mr. Chair, I was only trying to find out, maybe we can talk later about what you meant by the next step when you referenced Perpich, because they, I'm not sure exactly what that means when you talk about working with school districts on curriculum and so on, because that's part of their mission. And so it'd be interesting to know from my perspective what that next step
is. This is a really, this is not simply working with a school relative to a curriculum or an arts curriculum, which is what Perpich has been doing. This is to integrate in a very intensive way an arts curriculum with the regular school curriculum. And that's why I suggested that if you look at the achievement scores, these schools have been involved in math, science, reading. There's been some, and I've got the book across the hall in my office. There's been some significant increases, which were striking in these really difficult schools. And both, obviously, you and Representative Marquardt have been very involved with K-12 education over the years here. But I was a little bit more of a novice to it. I was really struck. So,
well, we indicated we would adjourn between 6 and 6:30.
Yeah, and that's
I have
that's
no further business.
So, and we'll talk about, well, I think, members, what we'll try to do on Monday is try to, since everybody will be here, is to revisit some of these other sections where we have the legislators present.
And that's what I mentioned to our staff, Ms. Conley, earlier, was that it looked like we had part of the agenda from today that would carry over until Monday. So I think that's agreed upon.
Okay. If nothing else, we'll see everybody Monday.